From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Globalization involves a lot more than an expansion of business markets. How conscious should we be of the consequences of all that contact? Are we prepared to deal with diseases that know no boundaries and require only a breath or a slight touch to infect and kill? Carl Taro Greenfeld was living in Hong Kong and working as the editor of Time Magazine Asia at the time of the SARS outbreak in 2003. His new book, China Syndrome, is an in-depth look at the 21st century's first epidemic. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
And this book has already been excerpted in a couple of magazines, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was in the Paris Review, this month it's in Foreign Policy, as it took a big piece of it.
So did they take only the scariest parts?
No, actually they didn't. I think there were more frightening parts. They took the parts that were probably easiest for American readers just to grab hold of and understand.
Your book takes us back to November 2002, before even the first article appeared in the Chinese press. What was happening then?
Well, I was running a magazine in Hong Kong, Time Asia, which is similar to Time in the U.S., only with Asian stories. And we had meetings every morning, and one of the things we began to hear about was there was this sort of rumor of a respiratory disease going through Guangdong, which is the province immediately north of Hong Kong.
What we call Canton.
What we used to call Canton, and some people still do. And we had heard that there was this respiratory disease, and there were rumors of people, you know, rushing to buy vinegar in the belief that boiling it would purify the air and somehow provide some kind of immunity. So these were just rumors, and we were discussing this in meetings, and I, being sometimes an unwise editor, said, "Nah, this is just one of those weird stories. Let's not cover it." But that turned out to be the first intimation that something was cooking over there.
And then the first story appeared in a communist-controlled paper. Do you think the reporters and editors there suspected what they were dealing with?
Well, I think there's great sensitivity to respiratory diseases in that part of the world because, you know, you've had several influenza epidemics that have sort of started there and then flared out around the planet. I don't believe that anyone at that time was suspecting that this was going to be as bad as it was, except for a very few doctors who had already been on the front end of it.
What were the Chinese papers reporting about the epidemic at first?
Well, essentially, the first reports were that there is no epidemic.
They said there's no epidemic, right. Which, of course, immediately sends off alarm bells.
I describe it as one of the least reassurances that I'd ever read, which was the front page of the Huyan Daily said, you know, government officials report there is no epidemic. Now, considering that newspaper had never reported that there was an epidemic before, if I were a local reader, I would find that alarming. And indeed, many Huyan readers did find that alarming, knowing as they do how to read between the lines of a party-controlled newspaper.
Was your staff then eager to get into the story? After all, it could have been quite dangerous.
I think that once the story really began to take off, we had no choice but to aggressively cover it. I think, and none of our reporters ever opted out of covering it, and they did a lot. I think, but initially, a disease outbreak is such a hard sort of story to get a handle on because it starts as rumors,
and then, as you say, when it's reported in the official press of China, you don't get the story either. Did they ever really fess up, or was that much later? The Chinese newspapers, did you ever really get a story that you could trust from any of those newspapers?
Much later, after the cover had been blown, in effect, the Chinese papers, Xinhua did do a few stories saying that certain officials had been purged because of misbehavior during the outbreak, but this was much later. Early on, it was very hard. Now, there were non-party-controlled newspapers, that is, commercial newspapers in Guangdong, that were doing very aggressive coverage of the outbreak early on. The party suppressed that coverage, and in effect, in early January, ordered newspapers to stop covering the disease outbreak.
How soon did scientists start working to determine just what this was?
I think almost immediately. The virologists in Hong Kong, especially because of sensitivity about avian flu, Hong Kong had had an avian flu outbreak in 1997 in which there were 18 human cases, six of which were fatalities. So there's always great awareness of avian flu in Hong Kong, much before the West was even considering it as a threat. So virologists there were already, as soon as they hear about things like this in China, their first thought is avian flu. So they were already looking north and trying to figure out what was going on.
But then all they have to do is look at the blood of someone who's infected, and won't they find the virus? Or was this a bit more complicated?
It was more complicated. Despite the fact that Hong Kong is now part of China, that internal border that divides Hong Kong from Guangdong is probably the most secure internal border in the world, meaning it's the hardest border to cross without proper papers. It's also a political border, but it's not obviously a border for infectious disease, meaning, you know, someone who's infected can cross that border. Doctors in Hong Kong, virologists in Hong Kong, while they were deeply concerned, they were unable early in 2003 to get any samples, to get any of actual samples of infected blood, which they would need to try to isolate a virus. There was great discussion in sort of within Hong Kong University, which is one of the premier virology labs in Hong Kong, as to how do we go about and actually get samples from Hong Kong. They'd asked through formal channels and been rebuffed.
And were there no decent research labs in all of China? I know Hong Kong is part of China, but the other part of China where this kind of research could have been done?
Well, there's a couple issues. Yes, there are first-rate labs in China. However, they hadn't necessarily turned their attention to this as aggressively as perhaps Hong Kong had. Many samples were going to a lab that was pursuing a different sort of theory as to what was causing the outbreak. This was the lab that would eventually come out and mistakenly claim it was chlamydia, which is a bacteriological infection. Also, the problem was that Chinese labs, as sophisticated as they were, many of those in Guangdong didn't have reagents for various types of avian influenzas, which they would have needed to find out if this was an influenza. Initially, you got to remember, everyone was worried that this was the avian influenza outbreak that the world now is again worrying about. That in early 2003, it really looked like you had, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of respiratory disease cases in China that were very quickly deteriorating to intubation. This meant that this looked like the front end of that outbreak everyone was worried about.
How many people died ultimately?
Ultimately, 800 plus.
That's a lot of people.
Under 1,000. Yeah, but much better than it could have been. Had it been influenza, we know it would have been devastating.
How was SARS first isolated as a coronavirus?
The first breakthrough occurred. I mean, one sample. There was a lot of scrambling to get samples. I mean, it turns out that from the outside in, as we look at these communities, we think, oh, well, these are diligent scientists, you know, carefully working to advance the cause of mankind as we fight all these deadly microbes. Well, actually, there's great jealousy within that community and among different scientists. And if you're in a disease outbreak, if you're a virology lab in a disease outbreak, and you get your hands on some good samples straight from some infected hospitals, you sort of, you know, cherish those samples because that's going to enable you to make the breakthrough that will garner you, you know, fame and prestige and all the future grants and so forth that you might desire. So after this sort of back and forth about who has samples, how can we get samples, this and that, HKU finally did procure samples after the disease outbreak was really severe in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong University,
that being HKU, yeah. And so once they had those samples, they were sort of able to methodically go through the various cell lines and try to find out what was causing, you know, what the cytopathic effect, the effect that was killing the cells. It was a little bit of a stroke of luck that they used a certain cell line that other labs hadn't yet tried and observed that it was killing these cells, and then were able to sort of back out of that and then figure out what the actual virus was.
My guest is Carl Taro Greenfeld, who's been editor and a writer for Time and Sports Illustrated, among other publications. From 2002 until 2004, he was editor of Time Asia, and that allowed him to be an eyewitness to the discovery of SARS, actually called H5N1. Why that? Why such a complicated name?
SARS is not H5N1.
Avian flu is
Avian influenza is
H5N1. Could you clean this up? Is SARS the bird flu we read newspaper reports about each day from all over the world?
No.
Today there was a thing about Afghanistan.
No. It's not influenza. It's a coronavirus. An influenza virus is a completely different species of virus. A lot of people reviewing the book have been making that mistake. The only similarity is really that they're both respiratory viruses that have jumped the species barrier from other animals.
Uh-huh. So they start the same way, but many other viruses start that way. And most of them start in Asia.
I don't know about most of them. Almost every virus that causes severe disease among human beings came from another animal at one point or another. Asia happens to be, or China happens to be, currently a great concern as to being a sort of provenance for emerging viruses because of the great degree of human and animal interaction. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that degree of human and animal interaction allows for a microbe to more easily jump from another animal into a human being.
Because they were kept in markets where birds and civets and all sorts of
other monkeys. The wild animal markets were
monkeys.
Sort of a crucial catalyst for this disease and sort of points to the issue wherever man is increasingly interacting with species with whom we haven't previously been in close contact, you have an increased risk of a new virus jumping species and causing great illness in human beings. Now, I mean, SARS is the first instance of this happening really since HIV, where you have a disease jumping the species barrier and then causing widespread human infection, you know, with multiple thousands of cases. Obviously, it happened with HIV 25 years ago. And that's why when this happens, as it happened with SARS, it's of such great concern. Because once there's a new microbe loose in humanity and it's proven that it can go from you to me, you have to take this very seriously as a terrible global threat. If the new bug isn't able to jump from you to me, well, then that's not as great a concern because we know what to do. Okay, we stop the interaction between you and whatever animal that came from, and therefore there will probably not be increased illness. But once it's loose in humanity and able to spread between us, you really are then in a sort of heightened danger zone. And that's what we're worried about with avian flu, that we may reach that point where it's spreading between human beings without any contact with poultry.
Mm-hmm. But right now it only happens when people have the contact with the poultry. The big concern poultry is popping up all over the world with avian flu now.
Right. And so therefore there's an increase. The threshold of interaction between humans and infected poultry goes up and the chance of mutation that will then allow for that human-to-human transmission increases.
But it took a long time for HIV/AIDS to become known as something that had jumped from other animals into the human population. Are we in better shape now because SARS is something we spotted very early?
I think we now have a blueprint for how a respiratory disease sort of emerges and what the response can be. Prior to SARS, if a patient showed up in a hospital showing, you know, some white out of the lung, some decreased blood oxygenation level, meaning he was having trouble breathing, doctors didn't necessarily isolate, quarantine, take all these certain prescriptive measures to try to contain the disease because we felt we had adequate medications to address this. We felt that antibiotics and antivirals and so forth could pretty much knock out whatever the bug was, even if it was assuming it was a human type influenza. Now, you better believe that if a respiratory case shows up in a hospital in Hong Kong or southern China, it's going to be taken very seriously. Now, that's in Hong Kong and southern China. In a strange way, I'm not as worried about those regions because they've gone through SARS. And likewise with Toronto and Singapore, you know, where you have hospital systems that have encountered a respiratory disease for which we don't have any cure. I'm a little bit more worried about those regions of the world that haven't yet experienced this kind of respiratory disease outbreak of an unknown infectious agent, because until a hospital goes through that, and I've spoken to a lot of hospital directors in Asia about this, until a hospital goes through that, you have no idea what it's like to have to impose that kind of strict infection control. Modern hospitals just don't do that anymore.
Well, we'd actually hope that it would be caught even earlier at airports, but right now nobody knows how to do that. My guest is Carl Taro Greenfeld. His book, China Syndrome, The True Story of the 21st Century's First Great Epidemic, is published by HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Carl Taro Greenfeld, who has been an editor and writer for Time and Sports Illustrated and was the editor of Time Asia from 2002 to 2004. He's the author of three books, Asia, Speed Tribes, and Standard Deviations, and now China Syndrome, The True Story of the 21st Century's First Great Epidemic. It is published by HarperCollins. I asked you earlier, and then we got sidetracked, about why it's H5N1. What is the significance of those letters and numbers?
The H stands for hemagglutinins, and 5 refers to the number of them. And it has to do with sort of surface proteins of the influenza virus. So when something's described as an H5 versus an H7, it's a way of identifying that virus by the number of proteins sort of that can be identified. It's just one way of signifying the difference between the different viruses. Most influenza viruses are generally referred to by an H something or other, an H1, an H7, an H5, and the avian influenza that currently is a cause for great concern just happens to be H5N1.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of organizations involved in keeping track of avian flu strains: the World Health Organization, Food and Agricultural Organization, and the World Organization for Animal Health. Do you think they know everything they need to about H5N1 by now?
I think they've made great progress since 1997 in terms of understanding it, and perhaps the greatest progress they've made, and I'm thinking specifically of the World Health Organization sort of Global Pandemic Preparedness Network, is making us aware of the threat that's out there and making us focusing international media very effectively on avian influenza as a threat. That said, we've successfully raised the alarm, but we don't know how frightened we should really be.
And if an epidemic were to emerge, does anybody have any idea of how to deal with it?
At this point,
are there any proposals in the works?
No. At this point, we're all sort of flying blind. I mean, we know the most effective thing is slaughtering chicken populations once they're, slaughtering infected poultry populations is the most effective measure. There's obviously a great financial incentive in terms of trying to produce a vaccine and so forth. So that that's going forward. The real question is, will H5N1 emerge as the next killer disease, or while the world is sort of worried about avian influenza and H5N1, is there actually another microbe that's out there that's going to? I happen to think that we're not going to have an influenza pandemic, in part because the whole world is obsessed with eradicating it. And as we see H5 rolling through more and more and more poultry populations and interacting with more and more human beings, I suspect that if this virus were to achieve widespread human transmission, it would have already happened, and it hasn't yet. So therefore, I'm not as concerned as a lot of people are. That said, I'm a writer, not a virologist. I'm a little bit more worried that while sort of, the global epidemic awareness sort of movement is focused on this one disease, that there's something else out there cooking, which is going to be sort of the great epidemic we're really worried about. SARS, before SARS, no one ever imagined you were going to get a virus jumping from bats to civet cats and into human beings.
But those markets, and I'd love to talk about those markets, have been changed, haven't they? What is one of those markets like? Have you walked through any of them?
Yeah, I mean, the most amazing thing to me has been the growth in wild animal consumption in southern China, which is directly linked to the prosperity of the region. Well, one of the unforeseen consequences of China's fantastic economic progress has been that one of the things that southern Chinese like to do to sort of celebrate their success is to sort of, nosh very widely through the wild animal kingdom. It's considered a sign of great face and good luck and so forth.
And the more exotic the animal,
the
better off you are.
The more face you get, So one of the surprises to me as I went back, I'd first been in wild animal markets in Guangzhou probably in the early 90s. And then there were sort of almost cute little sort of bazaars where you'd have a few species here and there, a couple snakes and a few animals that you hadn't seen before. But it seemed quaint and not at all threatening, because you would just sort of choose your animal and they would slice it and skin it and put it in the hot pot and prepare something for you. What has happened over the past sort of 14, 15 years is that these markets have sort of become industrialized, so that the scale of them has gone from where I remember this one little alley with sort of a few wild animal pens around it is now six massive markets, each with hundreds of stalls selling almost every species you could imagine.
And I'd imagine you can smell them from pretty far away because so many animals are being stuck together.
Yeah, I'll never forget sort of that kind of sour fecal smell of these markets where at some point sort of the smell of the urine and the feces is so strong you have to hold a handkerchief to your nose.
Well, can't the Chinese government do something to keep these markets cleaner and more humane?
They could. Right after SARS, there were efforts to regulate the markets a little better, and there was a movement to clean up these markets. That's been less effective maybe than it should have been. There's great economic incentive, obviously, in the wild animal trade. It's a pretty big business. Also, it's become sort of like a litmus test of Chineseness to say, I mean, much like, say, in America, you know, it's my right to own a gun or something for a certain segment of the population. There's a certain group of sort of southern Chinese nationalists who feels, well, it's my right to eat any animal I want. And it's almost anti-Chinese to sort of try to regulate too strongly against that trade.
But couldn't you just keep things apart? Say, okay, you'll keep all of this kind of bird together and all of that kind of bird together. And if you're going to eat civets, keep civets in a separate space.
That would be progress, not necessarily perfection. And there are...
I understand that sometimes they're actually stacked one above the other, and that automatically sounds to me like a prescription for disaster.
Again, it would be progress, certainly, to try to separate out species and to do this in a more sort of sanitary manner. But I still think as long as the goal is to sort of bring in as many wild animals and sell them as possible, you're going to still have this potential for kind of an industrialization of the wild animal business.
Where do they even find the civets? Are they indigenous to China?
Yes, they are indigenous to certain regions of China. They come both from Vietnam, from rainforests in Vietnam, and they're also farm raised in some regions of China.
And so they're shipped into this area in southern China because that's where the market is. And I wonder what happens when they're sliced up, cooked, and served as an entree. Are they checked for illness before that happens? Are people concerned at all about getting sick from eating a diseased animal?
It's not a very well-regulated business. Actually, I mean, the Chinese poultry business is actually better regulated than the wild animal business. So, no. And the animals, I mean, the animals aren't checked for signs of disease. If an animal's dead in the pen, it's not going to be sold. But that's not necessarily the most reassuring standard.
But you say you're able to purchase monkeys, bears, and snakes at a market. That's pretty incredible. Anything except a panda?
No, panda's off limits.
That's another Chinese thing.
That would be bad luck, I think.
But bears? I mean, that's pretty hard to keep in a cage, isn't it, in a market?
In a small cage, but and also kept alive in somewhat cruel conditions.
And as you said, the Chinese government is not really interested at this moment in controlling all of this, but the alternative is perhaps having to deal with a major pandemic in China.
But within the Chinese government, there's a certain segment that believes that SARS wasn't necessarily caused by the growth of wild animal markets, and that the civet cat, that since not all civet cats tested were positive for the coronavirus, they said, well, therefore civet cats weren't necessarily a vector species, so this whole thing is overblown. So let's just sort of repeal all the regulations.
Sounds like some arguments I've heard in this country for other kinds of repeals of regulation.
It's questionable science, but questionable science isn't solely a domain of the Bush administration.
Carl Taro Greenfeld, his book, China Syndrome, The True Story of the 21st Century's First Great Epidemic. It's published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Can any bird get this? Could a household pet like a parrot or a parakeet get this?
Get what? Get SARS?
Get the avian flu. I know, we're talking about two different things, but they're both, but they're still connected in the public's mind.
Well, there have been cats that have gotten it, right? I mean, that's, the, you know, that was...
Because civets are cats.
No, they're called civet cats, but they're actually a different it's a different rodent species. They're not feline. House cats have gotten tested positive for both at different times for both SARS and H5N1, but they didn't manifest disease, meaning they were carrying the virus around in them, but they didn't become sick.
What are the symptoms of each of these, SARS and H5N1?
Well, both are the first most pronounced system is very, very severe respiratory problems, which is coughing, shortness of breath, followed by rapid onset fever, muscle ache, body ache. You degenerate pretty quickly into into sort of a very low energy prone state.
And I imagine when this started showing up in rural areas, doctors were dumbfounded. They had no idea what to do.
Well, initially, in southern China at this time of year, you have a lot of people coming into hospitals with respiratory complaints anyway. It's winter, just as in New York. People get a bit, get a bit flu-y in the winter. So initially doctors would think, oh, well, here's just another person who is a bit under the weather, maybe more severely than others, but still. I think where they began to get concerned was they would see after someone would show up and present themselves at the hospital and appear almost as you and me, albeit with a cough and a fever, and within 2 days that person would be unconscious and on life support. Now, doctors hadn't seen this rapid deterioration from respiratory disease before. So, yeah, they noticed pretty quickly something weird is going on here.
And you say that on January 20th, 2003, a team of doctors from Huiwan, is it, convened at the Department of Health. You say that a report was compiled on the symptoms of this new disease and the number of infected and dead, and that was given to the health ministry in Beijing. What happened after that?
Well, that's always been a source of some discussion and hand-wringing among world global health experts, that within China, information about this new disease was and protocols to respond to it and treatments were already fairly well known, especially by a team of experts that had first gone to Huiyan, then had gone to Zhongshan and witnessed firsthand, okay, this is what this disease looks like, here's what the hospitals have done, and here's what we think should be done. If you go through and look at those memos and those reports, it's remarkably similar to what it took the rest of the world months to discover through, the very difficult learning process of watching patients die. Now, this was known in China in January, and it was passed up the chain of command to Beijing, and it was disseminated very tightly within the Chinese medical bureaucracy, whereas had this information, first of all, been known more widely in China, it would have saved a lot of lives. And even more important, or equally as important, if it had been passed out of China to the World Health, to the World Public Health Network, it would have saved even more lives.
And you say that reporters, in fact, were arrested, the ones who tried to report on the outbreak. It's so hard for me to understand why China thinks that this sort of thing can be suppressed and not backfire.
Well, China isn't alone in responding to a disease outbreak first with denial. I remember when HIV first appeared in the U.S., even in the gay community in San Francisco, there was a sense that, that this isn't a new disease. It's just sort of some puritanical doctors trying to end our good time. And the Reagan administration certainly was in denial about AIDS early on. So I don't single out the Chinese government for wanting to suppress information about a new disease. That's a pretty common government response. And in fact, if you look at what happened with SARS, the denial phase, you could say it didn't last as long as it has in the past in some instances. For example, with the U.S. and HIV. That said, one still has to censure the Chinese government for suppressing the information as long as they did. And yes, reporters were arrested, and it was certainly, if you were a reporter in Guangdong in January of 2003, you did not want to do a story on this.
Even though Hong Kong is part of China, would it have been easier to have done a story on it in Hong Kong?
No, Hong Kong. You could. You know, Hong Kong media can is much much freer than Chinese media. There's no comparison.
How closely is China working with the World Health Organization to prevent another outbreak of an infectious disease, whether it's these or something that may come along in the near future?
I think there's two different issues. I think at the central government level in Beijing, there's always been decent cooperation with the World Health Organization. I think it's at the local levels that information isn't as easily exchanged between local officials and international officials, and obviously that has to all go through the central government anyway. Immediately after SARS, there was certainly more cooperation and more of an effort to be part of the global community. However, now in the past sort of few months, you're starting to hear again about problems about the unwillingness to share samples, and information isn't being as freely exchanged as freely exchanged as it should be.
How effective has Tamiflu been in treating this?
I mean, Tamiflu appears to be, a pretty good, not an antidote, but a pretty good remedy.
So is there a lot of it in China now?
There's always been. I mean, the first time I ever heard of Tamiflu was in China when Chinese public health officials and doctors were telling me they take Tamiflu every winter, prophylactically. And I'd never heard about the medication until then, until I began doing this book.
Did you start taking it prophylactically yourself?
No, I never did.
There have been reports that the next epidemic could sicken 1 in 3 people in the world and kill millions. Is this likely, or is this just the kind of thing that some reporters come up with, the worst case scenario to sell newspapers?
I don't think it's necessarily likely. As I said, I'm not as alarmist about H5N1 as some other people are. I mean, that said, as I pointed out, I'm a writer and not a scientist. And if indeed 1 in 3 on the planet it becomes infected and dies in the next couple of years, at least their problem is going to be remembering who that writer was who said, "I'm not going to get sick." But there's always a chance of a new disease emerging and causing great havoc, and we've seen it. HIV was an example of that. Before that, you had the sort of Chinese influenza outbreak in 1968, and so you go on down the line. Periodically you have these new microbes emerging. Right now we're going through a sense in part because SARS was this weird alarm that went off, and now we have avian flu sort of rolling through these chicken populations. So there is a sense like something's coming. Does that really mean something's coming? Well, no, it doesn't necessarily mean that. And there's a certain community, the scientific community, that is sort of slightly more sanguine than the part that's getting more airplay right now.
Well, you live in New York now. You and your family have moved here. Do you feel any safer
than when I lived in Hong Kong? Well, actually, air quality in New York is much better than in Hong Kong. So there's one reason for being a bit more optimistic.
Carl Taro Greenfeld's book is China Syndrome, The True Story of the 21st Century's First Great Epidemic. It is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us
today. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.